We'll go ahead and get rolling tonight. We wrapped up last week. We wrapped up our discussion on mutations, and then also watched a short video on, basically had more to do with cosmology, but interesting video nonetheless. This week we're going to pick it up with a subject that is called homology. And homology is basically just a way of saying that there are similarities between species, and that the similarities between species, according to the evolutionary mindset, is evidence of evolution. So this is probably one of the most impressive arguments that you'll see, and one of the most commonly used ones. It's not often called homology in the day-to-day terminology, but basically it comes from the realm of comparative sciences, or the process of comparing one organism or group with another organism or group, and documenting the basic similarities. So the purpose of this next section of the study is to provide a couple of things. Number one, a basic understanding of the evolutionists' mindset in this, and some of the arguments that they use, the case from homology. And then, of course, to analyze that case through the prism of truth for the purpose of making a defense of the creationistic view. So we're going to talk about what it is, and then we're going to analyze the position. So there are a lot of related fields in the comparative sciences, such as comparative anatomy, comparative embryology, comparative physiology, cytology, biochemistry, etc., etc., etc. It's a very common realm of science. It's actually I believe you can get a doctorate in homology. It's like, you know, remember those problems you had as a kid in grade school, and it said compare and contrast? Yeah. Imagine doing that your whole life. Anyway, there are several fields in the comparative sciences. And when you make comparisons of organisms or parts of organisms, scientists commonly speak of what's called homologous structures. Okay? Evolutionary scientists use the presence of these similar structures to suggest a common ancestor. And to put it another way, homology suggests that when a feature exists in two or more species, it is the same because of descent and evolved from the same feature in the last common ancestor of the species. Okay? So in other words, if you have two different organisms that have similar structures, similar features, that they both came from or descended from the same organism somewhere earlier on in its evolutionary process, quote unquote, because that presence or that structure had to have been present in some way, shape, or form. Okay? You'll hear this often, especially used in reference to horses. There are a lot of different kinds of horses, and horses have very similar features, of course, but we also have very similar features to a lot of what horses have in terms of their wrists and actually even in their legs. So we'll talk about other things. For instance, some other things that you'll see, the human heart. There's an organism that runs around and tastes really good. It has a very similar heart to the human being, which is a pig. That's probably why bacon tastes so good. But at any rate, well, that could be taken really wrong. At any rate, evolutionary scientists basically suggest that because there are these common traits, that they came from the same critter. So R.L. Wysong, wrote a book called The Creation Evolutionary Theory. In 1976, he said, much of the case for amoeba to man evolution, by the way, my favorite one is goo to you, from goo to you, evolution, is built upon arguments from similarity. Evolutionists argue that if similarity can be shown between organisms through comparative anatomy, comparative embryology, vestigial organs, cytology, blood chemistry, protein, and DNA biochemistry, then evolutionary relationship can be proven. So their point is that if we can show enough similar structures in enough different areas between two organisms, then that is proof of evolution. That's their perspective. Michael Denton, He wrote a book called Evolutionary Theory in Crisis. He wrote extensively about arguments from homology. Denton's assessment is as follows. Since 1859, the phenomenon of homology has been traditionally cited by evolutionary biologists as providing one of the most powerful lines of evidence for the concept of organic evolution. This, of course, was written in 1985. Charles Darwin himself thought the argument from homology, as one of the single greatest proofs of his theory. In his book, Origin of Species, Darwin wrote, "We have seen that the members of the same class, independently of their habits of life, resemble each other in general plan of their organization. Is it not powerfully suggestive of true relationship, of inheritance from a common ancestor?" Again, in other words, similarities to them, to the evolutionary mindset, points to a common ancestor. This, of course, was written in 1859. So, not surprisingly, the phenomenon of similar structures between species continues to be a mainstay of the argument for evolutionary theory. In the 1947 high school textbook, General Biology, the author suggested that the greater the similarity of structure, the closer the relationship, and wherever close relationship is found, a common ancestry is indicated. So, while they're not saying that it's proof, they're saying it's proof. Because they're not saying it's suggested, it's indicated. Big difference. A couple other ones, 1981, Encyclopedia Britannica, also had something very similar to say. It said, "The indirect evidence for evolution is based primarily on the significance of similarities found in different organisms. The similarity of plan is easily explicable if all descended with modification from a common ancestor by evolution, and the term homologous is used to denote corresponding structures formed in this way. In invertebrate animals, the skeleton of the forelimb is a splendid example of homology. In the bones of the upper arm, forearm, wrist, hand, and fingers, all of which can be matched bone for bone in rat, dog, horse, bat, mole, porpoise, or man. The example is all the more telling because the bones have become modified in adaptation to different modes of life, but have retained the same fundamental plan of structure inherited from a common ancestor." So basically what they're saying is that because of the fact that there are similar structures in the forelimb between the rat, dog, horse, bat, mole, porpoise, man, that we all came from the same critter somewhere down the line. Okay? So, I did put the rest of those in there. Huh, you probably could have read it along with me. Sorry. A quick study of the online encyclopedia Encarta tells you how long ago I put this class together, because I don't think Encarta's existed since like 2009. But at any rate, at the time, a quick search of that online encyclopedia returns the information concerning evolution and homology. It says, "A study of comparative anatomy, homology, has revealed many instances of correspondence within various groups of organisms, and these bodily structures are said to be homologous. Evolutionary biologists suggest that such homologous structures originated in a common ancestor. The differences arose as each group diverged from the common ancestor and adapted to different ways of life. The more recent the common ancestor, the more similar the species." So, from these few examples, we can see that the prevailing teaching of modern evolution is rather dependent upon homology. It is dependent because it is the primary supporting evidence of evolution. So, Michael Denton, he actually acknowledged the importance of the thinking of homology and how all these structures relate to one another. And he explained it in this way. He said, without underlying homologous resemblance in the fundamental design of dissimilar organisms and organ systems, then evolution would have nothing to explain, and comparative anatomy nothing to contribute to evolutionary theory. So in other words, I hope you're understanding just how important this particular argument is in the general theory of evolution. And in fact, when you think about it, most of the conversations you'll have with people that deal with evolution, they're probably not thinking at the molecular level. They're probably not thinking at the cosmic level. They're probably thinking, because of the fact that I see similarities, and I've been told that there are similarities between chimpanzees and human beings, that we are therefore descended from the same organism. That's the level. This is the level where most people are. Okay, so it's obviously pretty important to understand how this works and really what's the argument. So as we move on here, a couple of other things. Isaac Asimov, he was one of the America's most prolific science fiction writers and science writers, suggested that our ability to classify plants and animals on a groups within groups hierarchical basis virtually forces scientists to treat evolution as a fact. So because of the fact that we can group organisms in like kinds, to Isaac Asimov, it forces us to believe in evolution. So give you an example, and I like this is my favorite example. Okay, I'm going to say it again. You can say it with me if you'd like. All chihuahuas are dogs, but not all dogs are chihuahuas, right? So while you can have many different kinds, many different variations within a kind, and then group them all together, so you have wolves and coyotes and foxes and St. Bernards and chihuahuas and et cetera, all these different kinds, and then you can take a different kind and take, say, cats or felines and group all those together, and then you can compare those two different groups and see very similar structures between the two. The assumption then is that those, the dog and the cat at one point had the same evolutionary ancestor. And this is essentially what he's saying. So, Isaac was certainly not a dumb man by any means, but classification based on similar traits makes sense. I mean, if you're just, let's look at something very simple. And I realize it may not be the breadth of the example, or it may not fit the breadth of the example, but it's pretty obvious. When you wash your clothes, you don't just throw them all in, blacks, whites, reds, colors, towels, sheets. Oh, good for you. Well, I have four kids, so they wash their own laundry, thank you very much. But the thing is that you're supposed to separate them. If you want your whites nice and bright white, you put them in hot water and you put in, you know, bleach, and you make sure they're nice and white, et cetera, et cetera. So it makes sense to separate things. It's a very natural and seemingly logical classification. So there's a large amount of data also to support this. So when we discuss homologous traits and structures, it appears to be a very logical argument for descent from a common ancestor. After all, that's how we explain why brothers and sisters look more alike, like each other, than other relatives, such as cousins. Right? Although, if you've ever met my brother, he looks more like Kevin than he does like me. So, but the thing is that that's how we explain that. Well, you know, brother and sister, parents, much more closely related than, say, cousins and so on and so forth. Makes sense. And evolutionists, as I mentioned, have a large amount of data at their disposal. So one set of such data is that the wing of the bat, the forefoot of the turtle, the forefoot of the frog, and the arm of the man all have the same general structure. Evolutionists also point out correctly that the forefoot of the dog, the flipper of the whale, and the hand of man contain essentially the same bones and muscles. If you think back to your discussions and classes in biology in high school, and maybe you've watched some documentaries that are, you know, put out by BBC America or the Discovery Channel or any of those, anytime you look at a critter, like say a bat, that's the classic one. Every time you see somebody dealing with a bat and they hold it out and have its wings, and then they almost always will point out, see how similar the bat's wings are to our forearms and see how it has five little fingers on there. I mean, they always point that out, right? They always point out those similarities because it's the assumption that bats and humans had a similar ancestor down the road. So, Michael Pittman here, he pointed out that the evolutionist, or to the evolutionist, homologous structures are clear evidence of common ancestry and a family tree of life. Bat wings, bird wings, flippers, human arms are similar because the ancestors common to birds, bats, and humans had just a structure. A forelimb built on the pattern that biologists identify as pendactyl or five-fingered. So, pendactyl limbs, pendactyl just means five-fingered limbs, are common in many different organisms. In more recent times, to the molecular level, as scientists begin to compare similarities in all kinds of things. So, looking at the screen there, this is a very standard illustration of what pendactyl means, or how it's illustrated. And it says, in the center there, it says, the pendactyl limb, as the ancestral terrestrial vertebrate's limb plan, subsequently adapted by modification for different uses and or habits. It's a layout of a five-fingered pendactyl limb. So, if you know anything about basic anatomy, that thing in the middle kind of looks like a hand. Five fingers, basic bone structure in the forearm, a joint, single bone, and then, of course, in the wrist, you can see multiple bones. And they have examples on the screen there. They're all over the place. And they all have, they may not be exactly the same size, but they certainly all have the same components. So, these things, and this is often something that you'll see when they're trying to find evidence for intermediary species between water and land as well. Yeah. I think that's where I'm going with this. So, here's the other thing. Not only can we see similarities in the organism, in the parts that we can visibly see without the aid of microscopes, but similarities also exist at the molecular level. There are several different examples of this. For instance, blood groups, cytochrome C composition, enzymes, cellular DNA, and many other microbiology entities. There's a lot of similarities in all of the structures within organisms. Well, in many of the structures in organisms. So, one such famous example came from a study completed in 2002 that suggests that the DNA of a chimpanzee and human is similar 95% of the time. Now, I put 95 to 98 because this number changes all the time. It seems to swing between about 98 and about 90%, depending upon who's doing the research. Okay? The bottom line is that you don't need a molecular biology degree or in genetics to see the similarities between chimpanzees and and human beings. So, just kidding. There are obvious physical similarities. Okay? So, the conclusion is that the conclusion we are supposed to reach is that evolution is true because we can trace our lineage back to a common ancestor who lived millions of years ago. Okay? So there you go. Not sure why. I guess he was trying to illustrate that there's similarities between chimpanzees and humans. Okay? So, what are we to do in the sight of this overwhelming evidence? We're supposed to panic, right? We're supposed to give up and walk away. Because there's no way we can make sense out of any of this. There's no way that those of us who don't have PhDs and wear white lab coats and teach in colleges or universities would have any idea how any of this stuff can possibly make any other sense than what it does according to them. Well, obviously, we don't want to panic in all of this. So, do the similarities mentioned actually exist? Well, yeah, of course they do. And the truth is going to come out in all of this. The truth does prevail in all of this. And really, if they do exist, what is our response? Okay? What's the explanation? Well, serious questions need serious, thoughtful, logical, reasoned answers. It's interesting because oftentimes people will make statements about what they think they know, but they haven't thought through what their statements actually mean. I had the opportunity to sit down with a gentleman that a brother in Christ has an opportunity to study with, and we sat down, and he's a seemingly intelligent young man, and we had an interesting discussion. And it was funny because I want to pick on him, but one of the things that's happening is that he was making bold statements about things that he didn't know anything about. And because of course he's very much in the evolutionary camp and so on and so forth. It's interesting because if you actually work people back and help them understand what they're saying and what that means and what the implications of those things are, hopefully those logical, reasoned answers that you're going to give them are going to lead them to the truth. So, as creationists, we have a significant task ahead of us. We have to understand homology, and we also need to be able to launch an apologetic rebuttal to the evolutionist argument. And our next section will help us develop that defense. Now, a couple of things, just as a side note here. There are 3 billion, with a B, base pairs within the human genetic structure. So if human beings and chimpanzees have a 98% similarity between them within their genetic structure, then 2% would mean that in order to bridge the gap between humans and chimpanzees through mutations, 60 million base pairs would have to change, rearrange, correct, or mutate in precisely the correct order. There's a lot of base pairs in the human genome. 3 billion base pairs. 3 billion. That's a lot. And a 2% difference is 60 million base pairs. So while they don't present it that way, do they? While there are 60 million different differences in the base pairs between chimpanzees and humans, well, if they use that number, it seems rather large. But if they say 2%, that's a bit small, isn't it? So just as a side note, we'll talk a little bit more about this as we go. So the brief examination of the evidence from homology supporting evolution illustrates the strength of the argument. In light of this evidence, we can't panic. So we want to look at 3 specific areas in the realm of homology. First of all, we want to look at the big picture. We want to look at genes and chromosomes. And then, of course, we're also going to look at embryology. So before we begin, let's discuss what our response should not be. First of all, you cannot deny the existence of similarities between organisms. Similarities do exist. It doesn't help the argument for creation, nor does it help the argument for faith if we put blinders on. Because nobody wants to talk to anybody and follow somebody who has blinders on. At least if you're a thinking person, you won't want to do that. Okay? So we can't bury our heads in the sand and just say, all those things don't exist, that's not true, and just walk away. That's helpful. It's actually not helpful. So, we can't deny that the similarities exist. Second, we cannot be ignorant of the facts. Denying the basic similarities serves no good purpose. It also makes you look foolish when you're trying to attempt it, and neither does having no idea of what they're talking about. So that's part of the purpose of this class, is to get you engaged and to get you to think about it, to hopefully help you find some things that interest you so that you can find out more about it. And also, you cannot be ignorant of the facts, as I mentioned. One of the things that we're going to find is that the data that we're going to look at is not in dispute. Okay, so there's a powerful lesson in all of this. Not only can we not deny that they exist, because they do, but we also cannot be ignorant of the facts. And there's a powerful lesson in this. And that lesson is that rarely is it the data that are in dispute. It is in the interpretation placed on the data that is in dispute. And this is, interestingly enough, that gentleman that I was talking about that I had a chance to study with on Monday, or have a discussion with, I should say, this is his point. He said, you and I are going to look at the same information, and we're going to come to two completely different answers. And I asked him, what's 2 plus 2? 4. I said, so is 2 plus 2 4 always? Yeah. So how far away do you have to get before 2 plus 2 isn't equal to 4? Well, I don't know. I mean, I've heard of things where 1 divided by 1 isn't 1, or it isn't 0, and 1 minus 1 isn't whatever. I didn't say that. I asked him. I'd like to see the research on that. That's very interesting. When a number divided by itself isn't equal to 1. I'd like to see that information, you know? At any rate, the thing is that to the honest person, if we allow the data to speak for itself and not try to place a presupposed or pre-assumed interpretation on the data, we will hopefully arrive at the truth. So, this heralds back to one of our initial discussions in the class, the observer expectancy effect. Remember, that is the one that says, basically, that the observer is always biased. Also, denying the data serves no purpose. We cannot, as I mentioned, deny it because it makes us look foolish. And in reality, the data itself is neutral. Evolutionists suggest common ancestry. Creationists suggest creation according to a common design or designer. Here's the thing. We expanded the building, what, about a year ago? 2 years ago? Whatever. It's been a while. And you notice that we use the same materials. The walls match. We have the same windows throughout. And really, if you were to take the sheetrock off the walls and look at the construction, it's going to look very similar to pretty much every building you've ever been in Montana. Unless, of course, the house is built, unless it's a building built of steel, etc., etc. But even in that, there's going to be very similar processes in that. Like, for instance, when we ran electrical from the back of the, panel to the back rooms, we used electrical cord. We didn't attempt to try to use garden hoses. Really? Because why? Because these things, these models, these structures, they're proven to be effective to handle whatever it is that we're trying to handle. Super Dave.
You can do that in any aspect. If you take a designer for a house, somebody that's an architect, he can design a house a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
Every house he designs is going to be on a similar basis.
Yep.
That same person can take and design an office building or a tower downtown. Still have a lot of similarities to his character.
Yep.
That doesn't mean that that tower downtown is in connection with the house. So why would it make sense that there's any similarities between every species on the planet coming from the same creator?
Yeah.
Doesn't mean we all come from the same ancestor.
Right. And that's exactly the point, obviously, in all of this. And one of the things that's interesting in that is that you had mentioned something we're not going to talk too much about in the class, but I think it's worth mentioning. You'd mentioned architects as having a similar method or a similar style of building. Well, we all have very similar handwriting or similar styles of handwriting. And it's actually one of the things that's called autographs. It's a way that they use handwriting to be able to determine the age of documents. And it's interesting because we see the similarities in design, we see the similarities in structure in everything around us. Yes? Yeah, okay.
Hmm. So, no matter how similar, they don't do that anymore. Hmm. There's a reason.
Yeah, you're right. Although there are similarities, we're each finely tuned. And that's one of the reasons, we'll talk about this a little bit more detail, but the human heart and the pig heart are very, very similar. And, I mean, very similar in structure, and my understanding is that also very similar in the way that the blood vessels and the way that the arteries and all those things, how they connect. So, Why don't they just take the heart from the pig and put it into the human?
They used to eat that.
Exactly. They used parts of it.
Because it's size.
Mm-hmm.
And there's only a certain amount that they use out of these parts.
Right. And so it illustrates the point of, while there's similarities, we're still each different enough that we're not like, you know, Lincoln Logs, you know. We need a little here, a little... No, it's not the way that it works. Yeah, right. You bring your Legos, I'll bring mine. Well, no. So, of course, creationists suggest in all of this that there is a common design and designer in this. So, given the same data and two seemingly legitimate explanations for the same, for that set of data, a stalemate exists with neither side claiming a clear victory. Really. So this predicament leads us to the next section in our discussion, dealing with an examination of homology from a different, wider perspective. So what I want to start with now is looking at homology in terms of the big picture. As with many seemingly effective arguments for evolution, if we look at only a few specific examples or instances, we can get trapped in an endless cycle of debate that never allows a victory for the creationist model. A narrow field of discussion is not profitable. Okay? This is something also that you'll learn, or I've learned as a parent. Generally, if there are disagreements between two children, both of them only want you to pay attention to the portion that they are legitimately right about, and the rest of it that they've been picking on their brother or sister for the last 45 minutes, and the other sister or brother finally had enough, that doesn't apply. Okay? That's the same thing with the evolutionary model in a lot of cases in those arguments, is that a lot of the times they're going to go to the most powerful pieces of evidence first and focus on those, because if you take those powerful pieces of evidence and put them into a box that doesn't allow far further explanation or examination, of course, the argument can seem to be anything you want it to be. And as a side note, this is also true of the Scripture. I mean, I don't remember exactly what the joke is, but I usually paraphrase it often when I'm talking to people about the importance of looking at all the evidence and all the information. Guy was having a really bad day at the end of a really bad week, at the end of a really bad month, at the end of a really bad year, and he was ready to end his life, but before he did it, he figured, I'll flip to the Bible and I'll flip open the book and whatever it says, I'll do. And it says, and Judas went out and hanged himself. So not despairing and figuring, I'll try it one more time, he flips to the Bible again and it says, go and do likewise. And he's like, well, this is really not a good idea. So he starts flipping through the Bible. You get the point. You can get the Scripture to say anything you want if you put it in a box. Data is like that as well. I mean, this is a very basic tenet of really any kind of logical and reasonable discussion, is not to try to pigeonhole it. So a narrow field of discussion is not profitable. It never is. And so the best approach we can take is to widen the argument to include all the data from homology, because the evolutionist argument works only if certain portions of the data on homology are presented. If you take the wider perspective, the bigger picture, and you lay all that evidence out on the table, the evolutionary argument falls apart. So that's really the first step that we have to take. That's the first step in really breaking down this discussion. So, T.H. Morgan, he's a committed evolutionist of Columbia University, openly conceded many years ago what evolutionists do not want to become common knowledge. Okay? He said, if then it can be established beyond dispute that similarity or even identity of the same character trait in different species is not always to be interpreted that both have arisen from a common ancestor, the whole argument from comparative anatomy seems to tumble in ruins. So basically what he's saying is the same thing that Darwin said in his book, The Origin of Species. They're both basically saying that if we can prove that the hand of the human being and the wing of the bat came about independently, and we'll say from a common designer, then evolution falls apart. Okay? So it's a pretty strong argument to be able to break down. So evolution is a complete cosmology. In other words, it assumes that everything has to be the same. It must explain the differences as well as the similarities. It is a complete theory on it has to be. If evolution is going to be able to explain the similarities, it must also be able to explain the differences between organisms. Okay? Because remember, according to the evolutionary theory and the model, it is the reason we exist. It is the very spark of life. It is the very reason we are here. It's the reason we exist in the form that we do. So not only does it have to explain the similarities, but it must explain the differences to be a legitimate answer anyway. R.L. Wysong, he noted or stated, if a law of similarity can be used to show evolutionary relationships, then dissimilarities can be used to show a lack of relationship. So in other words, if similarities indicate a common ancestor, then dissimilarities indicate different ancestors. Plus, there should not be dissimilarities present within current evolutionary phylogenies that would contain a non-common ancestor. Okay? So, phylogeny is the pattern of ancestry and descent of species in evolutionary thought that's commonly represented as a tree and branch system. You guys have probably all seen something similar to this. Usually they're not quite that numerous in their species splits, but just as an example. The whole point that we're supposed to get out of this is that we all came from the same ancestor. So this is what's called phylogeny. It's the evolutionary history of a plant or animal. It's the study of how a group of organisms evolved. Okay. Franco Kiss, a dean of the medical faculties at the University of Budapest, once stated that it is necessary for the evolutionists, in order to maintain their theory, to collect only the similarities and to neglect the numerous differences. The chink in the evolutionary homology armor is the differences. Sir Alistair Hardy, he's a former professor of zoology at Oxford University, wrote, "The concept of homology is fundamental to what we are talking about when we speak of evolution. Yet in truth, we cannot explain it all in terms of present-day biological theory." In other words, they cannot explain the differences. Evolution has no way of explaining the differences between species and between kinds. Dr. Hardy's assessment here does a couple of things. It points out that homology bolsters the case for evolution only when evolutionists are allowed to cherry pick, if you will, pick and choose the similarities that fit their theory. When forced to include all of the available data in the examination, including those documenting dissimilarities, the argument for evolution from homology utterly fails. So again, it's important to step back from the tree and look at the forest. Okay? The casualness with which evolutionists discard unsatisfactory or unflattering data in homology to make it appear as though it supports evolution is a well-documented fact. Now that the pick-and-choose or cut-and-paste method has been exposed, Lester and Bolin have observed this. Another problem is that from the raw data alone, not one single phylogeny emerges, but several. The one that agrees most closely with the traditional phylogeny is assumed to be the most correct. This hardly demonstrates the independent confirmation of evolutionary relationships. The combining of several phylogenies from different proteins combines not only strengths, but also weaknesses. By the way, this is a quote from 1984, and the emphasis was in his original writing. He wanted to make sure that it was very clear that he wasn't happy with the fact that people were assuming the single tree phylogeny, and also that there wasn't just one. So what Bolin is saying is that when all the available homology data are examined, not one, but many root phylogeny can be illustrated, thus casting serious doubt on the ancestor common to all the species. In summary, well, one of the things we're going to do, we're going to look at another video here in the next few weeks. Kind of depends on how long it takes me to get to the rest of this. But we're looking at a video in the next few weeks, and they do an excellent job of explaining this. And here's the basic concept. Instead of having a single tree of life, God had an orchard. And he created all the kinds within themselves, and so that each kind could then reproduce, which also actually makes sense biologically. And then, when you let the science play out, and then you start applying some things from the Bible that take way too much faith for any logical reason person to think about, for instance, Noah's Ark, and you realize that God told Noah to bring animals of each kind, not every species, but each kind onto the ark, the ark all of a sudden, very quickly, becomes much more fathomable, much more practical. What's that? That's right. That's why we don't have the unicorn. But we do have narwhals, which are close. They just swim. And yeah, and they don't sparkle. Okay. So, in summary of homology, if we add up all of the available evidence, all the data from homology, and all the studies that are involved in it, it makes for an even weaker case for the evolutionary argument. With just a few pieces of data, we'll actually be able to look at some of these things and see pretty quickly that the argument from homology is not as strong as the evolutionary model would have you think. And so we'll leave that for next week. And then we'll start talking about some problems of homologous traits when those that should be very similar. Okay? Any questions? Comments? All right. Thank you again for your time.